This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We're now at episode number 48. And closing in on 50 episodes, and that's important because I don't know when you're listening to this, but I'm recording this little intro on Sunday, July 8th, 2018. Yesterday, the 7th, the Radical Therapist podcast celebrated 3 years of existence, and I just wanted to say, just give a public appreciation, deep appreciation for all the people that listen to the podcast, that have reviewed the show, rated and reviewed the show on iTunes, who have reached out to me via email for stickers or t-shirts or what have you, or just to send me notes of appreciation and thanks for doing this and being introduced to many new voices that are doing important work and inspiring folks out there, all across the globe. I mean, we have it's kind of exciting. We have an international audience, and we're all over the place. These radicals, they're everywhere. And so that makes me really happy. So it's been 3 years, 48 episodes, and excited about that. Trying to pump up the consistency of episodes, and that's kind of working on that goal this year, and seems to be going a little better. So with a lot on the plate, but we're still trying to make it happen, so that's good. So anyway, deep bow to everybody who listens, who downloads, who shares the work, and of course all the great guests that we've had on in the last 3 years that have made the time to share with us all about them and about their work, and it's just been amazing. And you know, and the real reason, and this kind of bleeds into our guest today, Hillary Canavy and Carmen Kuhl, who are going to be introducing or talking to us about anti-fat bias, weight stigma, and psychotherapy. And this is a really great episode. And the reason I started this podcast, or at least one of the reasons I started this podcast, is because I wanted, you know, I like ideas. I mean, I like being exposed to new ideas. I like seeing what people are doing on the edges. I like, you know, just... I just have been driven. My life, for the most part, has been driven by curiosity. And this podcast has been a great mechanism for me to, as an excuse, reach out to people that are doing interesting things and be able to learn more, because I'm tasked to learn more as I talk and speak and meet with them. And it's just been an amazing experience. And I've learned so much. And this particular podcast is one of those. I mean, this is... I don't think I've ever said this, but this is one of my favorite podcasts of the 3 years. It's definitely in the top five because it hit all the points for me, and that is, I learned something new. It challenged me in ways that I appreciate, and it has me thinking about my own work and how I move through the world. And I like when conversations do that to me and they destabilize me a little bit and I get to really chew on it. And this is one of those podcasts that both Hillary and Carmen, I think, really just, you know, have brought so much to the table for all of us clinicians to start thinking about how we might be colluding with anti-fat bias, weight stigma, diet culture, and how all these things are so heavily weaved through our cultures, society, what have you, and how, and in many ways, we've internalized them, and myself included. And so So this was a really great podcast, and I think you're going to get a lot out of it. Before I introduce you to them, a couple quick announcements. As always, please rate and review the show on iTunes. This is how we get out in front of people, they tell me. And so take a minute, go to iTunes, hit stars. I don't care how many stars you give us, just give us some stars. And then maybe write a little something, or don't. But if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. That gets us out in front of people. And also, there's a YouTube channel, and I think you might be interested in, if you're interested in the podcast. And if you go search The Radical Therapist on YouTube, we would really appreciate it. If you subscribed, hit the bell, and subscribe to the YouTube channel and watch the videos and share some of the videos. The piece I did on patriarchy and how it affects men's relationships is, I guess, mentioned in this summer issue of G's magazine, G-E-E-Z, which is Contemplative Cultural Resistance, is kind of their byline. And it is, I have subscribed to the magazine in the past, and it is good stuff. Cultural resistance with a contemplative slash kind of spiritual perspective, which I appreciate. And so some of that work, I guess, is mentioned in the summer issue, so look out for that. And but go to the YouTube channel if you can, and maybe share some of the videos, or at least subscribe to it. And you can always find us on social media. Go find us on their Instagram at The Radical Therapist, on Twitter at The Rad Therapist, and we have a website, theradicaltherapist.com, and of course you can email me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. So, and we do like the emails. So, okay, so let's get to our guests today, Hillary Canavy and Carmen Kuhl. And like I said, you're in for a good one today, and please share it with all your friends as well. But let's talk about, let's introduce you to Hillary. Hillary is a licensed professional counselor, facilitator, educator, speaker, writer, and activist. Hillary's private practice, where she specializes in disordered eating and dieting, body shame and weight bias and trauma, has been thriving for over 19 years. Her counseling framework is collaborative and informed by a relational, systemic, and social justice lens. Hillary has additional training in workshop facilitation, mind-body coaching, and is a certified Daring Way facilitator. She is a sought-after speaker on topics such as weight-inclusive approaches, weight bias, body trust, and the intersections of activism and therapy. And she offers individual counseling and coaching consultation and trainings for organizations and professional groups. And Carmen holds a master's degree in transpersonal counseling psychology from Naropa University. Carmen's a certified Hakomi therapist and founder and executive director of Boulder Youth Body Alliance. Carmen's been named most inspiring individual in Boulder County in 2012 and is the recipient of the 2013 Excellence in Advocacy Award from the Eating Disorders Coalition. Carmen is presented in national conferences all over the country, including the National Eating Disorders Association, Eating Disorders Network of Maryland, Girls Coalition of Minnesota, etc. And Carmen's approach is grounded in the health at every size philosophy, an approach that helps people live peacefully in their bodies, incorporate nourishing food, joyful movement, and celebrates the diversity of human bodies. So, without any further delay, let's meet Hillary and Carmen. Okay. Hi, Hillary. Hi, Carmen. Welcome to The Radical Therapist.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Before we get started, can I have each of you, just so our listeners too can know who's who, can I have each of you maybe introduce yourself and just tell a little bit about where you're at, what you're doing, and that kind of thing?
Yeah. So I'm Hillary Canavy. I'm a licensed professional counselor in Oregon. I live in Portland. I co-founded a business called Be Nourished, and we do work around healing relationship with food and body, and we call that work body trust. And we do quite a bit of training of healthcare professionals in this modality and how to move towards weight inclusive practice.
And my name is Carmen Kuhl. I'm a psychotherapist and educator in Boulder, Colorado. And I grew up professionally in the arms of some pretty radical fat activists and leaders of the Health at Every Size movement. I'm in private practice, and I also work a lot with young people and do some work with other professionals to learn to recognize and mitigate the impact of weight stigma in their work.
Great. Thank you. Okay. So let's get started. Your work is, I guess my first question is, your work is grounded in the idea that body liberation is a social justice issue. And I'm wondering if you could take that on right now.
I think as a place to start with that, I would say that, currently we're in a quote unquote war on obesity, right? And pretty intense efforts to prevent body sizes. And that we believe this is doing a whole lot of damage to our clients and to ourselves as practitioners. And to say that it's a social justice issue is to say that we honor the fundamental rights of fat people to exist without prejudice and discrimination, and believe that people's bodies are not problems to be solved. Yeah. Hillary, what would you add to that?
I think that there's a variety of ways in which the dominant and mainstream has illustrated what bodies are supposed to act like and be like and look like. And when we don't often, in social justice conversations, include fatness and sizeism in the conversation, because the culture largely believes that that is something that's highly correctable and should be correctable. And a lot of when we look at the data on obesity medicine interventions, we're seeing that this is a very failed paradigm over the past 60 years, and that encouraging people to diet and move towards weight change over and over again is causing a lot of harm to people. And we also see that when we look at this through the lens of intersectionality, that the intersections of fatness with all these other identities are further and further marginalizing people, and yet it very rarely gets named. And so it's definitely a social justice issue. And I think it's really imperative to clinicians. It's something that clinicians, I think, don't exactly know what to do about. And I think a lot of us are believing that it's somehow our role to wake larger people up to the reality of their bodies, and somehow that would be pro-health in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think that style of intervention is not really, really supporting our clients in any kind of connection to their body or being able to occupy their body in any way. And it's very much colluding with the culture of anti-fat bias and the dieting industry, which is essentially not supporting any kind of change process in our clients.
Yeah. Do you want to say something, Carmen?
Yeah, I just want to say that I think as therapists or providers, that we have to deconstruct the way that oppressions determine the ways we value people and whose bodies have access to rights and resources.
Yeah. And I asked somebody, this is a learning experience for me. I'm really glad we're having this conversation, and I'm glad it's going to hit a lot of people too. I guess my next question is, you argue anti-fat bias is persistent in contemporary psychotherapy. And I know, Hillary, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could say more how that's showing up in our therapy rooms.
I think there's an automatic collusion often that if someone's living in a larger body or a fat body, that they probably want to change it, and that they should want to change it. And I think in the psychology psychotherapy world, there's also an idea that fatness or body size signals something about that person in terms of their psychological wellness. And there really isn't a lot of good information that really holds that up, in terms of data or the way we look at this. And when we look at it through that lens, we aren't really considering how a lot of the presentation of people who live in larger bodies may be very related to the amount of weight stigma they experience, either consciously or unconsciously, in the world as it is right now.
I think that, you know, we've trained as therapists under a weight bias system, that it's always been there and that we've never really existed without it. And Chris, I got a hold of that book, The Radical Therapist Collective.
Yeah.
And in there, somewhere in there, I just recently read, there are 10 things we can do. And one of them was, we can attack therapy bullshit whenever we encounter it. And I love that so much because I feel like this is a place that I want to attack bullshit in the way that fat bias continues to show up in therapeutic encounters over and over again. I think it's a real, it's an ever-present aspect of therapy. Therapy is not a place where wage is value neutral. And as professionals, we don't even see the limitations in our own office furniture, right? So how can we see the limitations in our own belief systems?
Yeah.
And if we're reading information, if we're reading information about a person by assessing their body size, that's not expertise, actually, that's prejudice, right? So I think it's our ethical duty to unpack and address this, and shift our focus from trying to change people's bodies to the human beings who inhabit those bodies, right? And their right to exist in the world exactly as they are.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing in our training that would indicate that we have any expertise over the size and shape of people's bodies, even in eating disorder treatment training. There's nothing. And so we have to acknowledge that if we are approaching clients or having conversations with clients about the size of their bodies, that that is coming from mainstream culture. Mm-hmm. And you know, this conversation above many is really an attempt to norm people to a very, very disordered culture around food and body.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I guess you have me wondering how, I know you do a lot of speaking and training and that kind of thing. How are clinicians responding to your work?
They're relieved. I think largely they're relieved. I think that, you know, somehow we've taken on the idea that we're supposed to be addressing this issue somehow in the clinical space, and no one feels adequately trained to do so. Most of my clients either have had the previous experience of being encouraged to go to Weight Watchers or some other mainstream diet program by their previous clinician, even though they've tried and tried and tried, maybe tried harder at this than anything else, or the client or clinicians just say, I'm not trained to deal with this. And while I'm sure that's very true, because I wasn't either, I know that virtually almost every client walking in the room could probably have something to unpack around this topic.
Mm-hmm. I think along with relief, sometimes what also shows up is some feelings around kind of having people's complicity get a little unsettled, right? That I think it's helpful when people bring a willingness to not be right about this and to question the ways they have unwillingly and unknowingly and unintentionally colluded with a system that really harms people around weight and bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's destabilizing. And the task is always, can you lean into that a little bit, right?
Right, so, right. Yeah.
Okay, and you brought up diet culture, and I know in your work you do take on diet culture, and I know this is a very prominent aspect of our contemporary society, right? And so I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about the influence of diet culture and how it influences therapists.
I mean, I think diet culture is based on the idea that fatness signals unhealthy always in all bodies all the time, and that there's something that we can do about it. And I think lots of folks are unaware that I think, you know, 95% of diets fail at 2 to 5 years after the diet, which means that people regain the weight they lost and then often gain more. A lot of the clients I work with, you know, often wish that they were at the weight they were at when they began dieting.
Always, yeah.
To contribute greatly to the weight of our population over time. So dieting culture, you know, it's very neoliberal in a sense, you know, that an individual can approach an industry and do their change work, right? And it doesn't deconstruct anything in the culture that is contributing to ill information about bodies, or is it stigmatizing bodies and then profiting off of bodies? So diet culture permeates everything. You know, it's this constant hustle to be healthy. And we don't know why exactly. We, you know, is this to avoid death? Is this to prolong life? Is this an expression of perfectionism and control? It's hard to say, but I do think that we know that this idea that healthism, this idea that health is the end all be all of our existence, is really rooted in more in industry than in wellness. And I often wonder if a lot of the clients that we're seeing are really hustling for worthiness in a culture that promotes healthism more than they're actually hustling for health.
Yeah. Can you say more? And this was a new word for me, the healthism. And so, could you say more about that? How it is problematic? And, because when I did get the gist of it, it was like, oh, that's so predominant, right?
Yeah, it's into the fabric of everything,
right?
You know, it's really hard to suss out. And I think it's the place where, when we start to look at healthism, it can be the most confrontational, particularly around our own health practices. But healthism is the thing that upholds health and the participation in health behaviors as something that's inherently productive for individuals and in fact improves the overall culture, and that if people aren't doing that, they're somehow detracting from the culture. I also think it tends to highlight individual behavior change as opposed to looking at the social determinants of health, which have a far greater impact on overall health status than changing individual behaviors. And so healthism is this conversation that almost mutes social justice because it doesn't allow us to take into consideration all the systemic and institutionalized barriers to accessing care and also to having a life free of stigma and discrimination, which certainly impacts health.
I noticed that for myself, I don't even use the word health very often anymore in my work with people because it's become so loaded. And, you know, I think if we're talking about health, but we're not talking about who has access, then we're not talking about health.
Right.
Right. And that when we have a dominant culture defining what health is, then that dominant culture is inserting its own ideas about what's appropriate and what's not and what works and what's acceptable. And I think that's a dangerous and loaded word when that's what it ends up being.
Yeah. And like you said, it's in the fabric of everything. I just want to share a personal experience. I went to the doctor recently, right? And I'm sure you've heard all the stories about that, right? And I did, and my weight was the topic of consideration. So, what do we do about that when you know you're up against the professional discourse, right? And then even in my own personal life, but I left not feeling good about that whole thing, right?
Right. So, yeah. Well, what do we do about it? I mean, we would love to change the conversation significantly so that clinicians of all kinds are not approaching people's wellness through their weight. I mean, the assumption that weight is the indicator of health is really misguided. And it's usually alienating. You know, most of the people I work with who are fat or live in larger bodies avoid healthcare because of those interactions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're looking at something that systemically is perpetrating what it's trying to avoid.
Which is ultimately, you know, screwed up and ironic in a way, because if we say we're concerned about fatness under the guise of wanting people to be healthy, but then we don't make healthcare environments welcoming to people, then I think that's bullshit, right? I'm calling bullshit again, right? I don't think that means we actually care about people's health. I think it's much more about prejudice and discrimination and continuing to perpetuate a system that gives privilege to certain bodies over others.
I mean, health has become this word that we use to excuse away our conditioned disgust and reactivity to body difference. You know, there is no reason why people should be treated differently based on weight. And yet that is the common experience and people often expect it. And I think that is not being looked at. And healthism is kind of the veil that keeps us from really looking at the injustice in that.
You want to say something, Carmen?
Well, I was thinking about your experience, and I'm thinking about the ways that weight also is just the quickest and easiest thing to measure, yeah. right? And that many physicians or healthcare providers don't have the time really in many ways to sit with a person and ask what else is going on in their life and to find out the ways that they're taking care of themselves and, you know, that kind of stuff. That it just becomes this easy thing to hang everything on the BMI, right? Which is, I think, where the Health at Every Size movement started to take a look at and say, there's got to be other ways to practice healthcare behaviors that don't automatically link to weight and have that be the thing or the lens that we see everything through.
And, you know, that when we're saying, you know, I heard it in recent eating disorder conference, someone describe you continuing to use BMI, even in eating disorders, which mm-hmm. is so damaging, as convenient. And I think when we're when we're hearing this word convenient, we have to be asking, like, for who?
Right.
Who is this convenient for? Well, right. It's convenient for insurance companies and very busy physicians. And, you know, most insurance companies, like when I go to the doctor, I go to a doctor that does not weigh me, and they take two other vitals. They take my blood pressure and they take my heart rate. And that is also a vital that can be reported to insurance companies.
Right.
So I think that we need to really look at this, you know, deeply.
You brought up the Health at Every Size movement. I'm wondering, I don't know much about it, and I was wondering if you could, you know, share with me and our audience about that movement.
Sure. The Health at Every Size movement or paradigm is a model that really grew out of anti-diet and fat acceptance communities in the late 80s and early 90s. And it started out as conversations among clinicians who were seeing the failure of the intentional weight loss as intervention paradigm. And eating disorder specialists also who were connecting problems across the weight spectrum and weight stigma. And they wanted better medical care, right? So it grew out of that and became some guiding practices that clients could engage in if they choose, that references their own internal wisdom about what they need. So Health at Every Size became a way that personal health practices became behavior-centered and weight-neutral rather than weight-based and weight-driven. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So there are things that we can do, things that I can do to improve my health and well-being that are independent of my body size and without engaging in the project of trying to manipulate or change my body size. It also acknowledges that not everyone has access to behaviors that might improve or resources, right, that might improve their well-being. It also says that freedom from discrimination and stigma is a super important component of health that often gets left out of the conversation. And that everyone has a right to prioritize how much they want to choose to prioritize their health. And again, going back to what Hillary said, the pursuing of health is not a moral value and not everyone is obligated to do that. And health is not I live in Boulder where this is just everywhere that yeah. someone's, you know, in Portland too, I think, right? Where wow, someone... Yeah. Pursuit of health says something about who they are in the world, right? And who they get to be. It's not a barometer of worthiness and it's not always entirely within our control. But go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think, you know, it's important for clinicians to really sit with this and consider this because sometimes the Health at Every Size movement gets co-opted a little bit or used in the way that it's like, okay, so I'm going to treat my fat patients equally and I'm going to offer, you know, they can work on their health, but we're not going to make it about weight. And I think there can be this like good, we call it the good fatty phenomenon. Like as long as fat people are behaving well, then we'll accept them.
Mm. Right.
You know, and I think as clinicians, we need to take it further. And that doesn't, and when clinicians are newer to Health at Every Size, that's not always what's happening.
Can you say, Hillary, you said something about body trust. I'm wondering how you conceptualize that idea.
Yeah, we, you know, over the years working with my clients, Dana, my business partner, and I have noticed that, you know, when we ask people, how did you lose trust with your body? Like, when did you learn your body was a problem? The answer is most typically before the age of 10, and that they learned it from a parent or a physician. And usually these people are very well-intentioned, well-meaning people, and most likely are trying to protect their kids from the weight, the huge amount of weight stigma in the world, the stuff that they themselves experienced or they have fear of the child's changing body. And we see that this is where trust gets lost, you know, the idea, you know, we're born into trusting relationships with our bodies. Like, you know, infants, toddlers know when they're hungry, they know when they're full, they know what they want, they know what they don't want. This is inherent to us as humans. And, you know, so body trust is about, you know, this process of how do we reclaim a connection, a trusting connection with our bodies in a culture that doesn't really trust bodies.
Thank you for that. Okay. In your work, you offer, and this is, I think, going to be really helpful for our listeners who are, I imagine, mostly clinicians. You offer 10 helpful ways to shift our therapeutic lens. And I'm wondering if you could kind of take us through these 10 ways. And I'm going to start with number one, which is consider the four steps in liberatory consciousness.
So liberatory consciousness is something that Barbara Love wrote about, and teachers that Hillary and I are learning from, Desiree Attaway and Erica Hines, have brought into their work. And I just love it because it's a framework for changing systems of oppression, right? So she outlines four developmental steps, which are awareness, analysis, action, and accountability. So around anti-fat bias, it means really starting to notice the ways that it shows up in the world, the ways that it shows up in ourselves, the ways that it shows up in the lives of our clients, and that a therapist doesn't have to occupy a larger body themselves to witness and know that all bodies are not treated equally, right? So as we become more aware of that and our analysis grows stronger, then we have to work to educate ourselves and to take action to change that, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me to help somebody learn how to love themselves or even just be in a healthier relationship with themselves if they then leave our offices and walk out into a world that hates them, that we need to take action to create an equitable world, as well as helping somebody heal their relationship with food and their bodies.
Great. And number two is interrogate your intentional or unintentional promotion of diet culture. Important one.
Yeah, I think this is an invitation to look at our own relationship with our bodies, our own dieting history, our own disordered eating histories, and understand what, you know, and really think about whether or not we've had access to healing around that work. You know, the idea that we can do healing around that work is even a little new in our field. And, you know, I think a lot of clinicians are making recommendations to clients based on their own experiences, what's working for their neighbors, what, you know, some article they just read. And there isn't a huge amount of depth of understanding around what we actually mean when we're talking about health, and that we aren't really, and there isn't a real strong interrogation of how diet culture works through us as people. When I work with clients, we're often looking at, you know, the internalization of diet culture, which we call the dieting mind. It comes from intuitive eating. And, you know, I think as clinicians, there is a need for us all to look at the internalization of the dieting mind to see if we can truly move towards a more liberatory stance around people's choices around their bodies.
Okay. Number three, and you've kind of mentioned this, but this idea of, and this is really prevalent, I think, in our work, and that's that stop diagnosing body size as a disease. And that's one of those conscious and even unconscious things that I think is happening a lot, yeah. Right?
Absolutely. We think we know something about somebody's health just by looking at the size of their body. And that is the link that we have to be diligent about breaking in ourselves, right? That the bias against fat bodies, or we didn't even talk about why we're using that word, actually.
Can you say something about that? Because I know some people might, you know, be wondering about that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sorry. So let's pause this part and go back and say that fat is a reclamation of a word that's traditionally been used to harm or insult or marginalize folks. And so much like the word queer has become a word that's been reclaimed, fat is also a word that's getting reclaimed, that by itself, it's just a neutral description of a body size or stuff that we have on our body, that it doesn't have to be this thing that we use to wound or to hurt ourselves, right? Yeah. Or other people with.
Like short or tall, fat or thin.
Right. Just a neutral description of a body. And it, so it's political in that way. And I know not everybody is comfortable with it. We also don't like the words overweight and obese, because overweight to me implies a correct norm that we're all supposed to be. And obese is just a medicalization of a body size. So fat's a word that we use. So not coming back, right, to this question, not assuming somebody's health status based on the size of their body, and understanding that that's one of the ways that bias operates, and that if we are working with people in higher weight bodies, that they have likely had that happen in their lives, and that we can help with that. I think one thing that it's important to remember is that if somebody with a thinner body was struggling with something, what would we recommend? And that should be the same thing we're recommending to someone in a fatter body. And that in the medical world, that's often not the case, that a whole separate set of recommendations are usually what's brought into the picture.
Okay. Number four is, you consider the link between emotional health and a fat oppressive culture. And I know you've touched on this a little bit, but I was wondering if you could say more.
Yeah, I think, ultimately we don't want to be in the business of helping people to become thinner, but we, as clinicians, we want to help them address internalized weight stigma and claim their right to exist in their bodies, as they are. For instance, I don't think that suggesting that weight loss will help people with their depression really takes into consideration that depression may be a very appropriate response to living in a fat oppressive culture, that we can focus on healing, not for the sake of weight loss, but for the sake of liberation and wellness, and that we acknowledge publicly and in our sessions that weight stigma is real and that it's been harmful. A lot of the times clients don't really see that as a valid form of oppression, and it's the internalization of that is so strong that they believe it's very much their fault that they're living in the bodies that they're living in. And most of the clients I've worked with have dedicated their lives to trying to change that, not with much luck often, or with a lot of yo-yoing. And so this what we can do that could be radically different is acknowledging that weight bias is influencing a lot of the choices that we're making in the name of health, and that in responding to weight bias in that way, we're not really improving well-being.
That's great. Okay. And always, number five is the important one, do your own work. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think of doing our own work as listening, first and foremost, right? Both internal and external listening, having a willingness to be open to what's happening in the room, what's showing up, who's showing up, and how that's landing in us, right? And being consistent and persistent around uncovering what our implicit biases could be. And then asking questions, right? Is it what I see or what I've been told, right? Questioning what we've learned and doing the work to unlearn that, and peeling away the layers of all of the assumptions that we carry about people. And I was in a presentation with Lama Rod Owens not that long ago, and he said, if we don't do our work, we become work for somebody else. And I think that is so important here. Right, that we need to intentionally change in the ways that grow our capacity to embody the liberated worlds that we long for, and also to acknowledge that we're also influenced by oppressive forces, right? And there's value in ongoing dialogue to address them. So finding safe places where we can question and not know and get it wrong and make mistakes, right? As Erica Hines says, we have to be humble and ready to fumble. And doing our own work, I think, means showing up with that willingness.
That's great. I like that quote. And that speaks to your next one, making our office spaces inclusive. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think this one's really basic and it gets overlooked quite a bit. It's like I think it's really important to know, like, do I have office furniture that fits a large variety of bodies? Do all my chairs have arms on them, for instance? Do people feel welcome and comfortable? Are they going to have to ask me for a different chair if I'm not aware of this? Will my chairs support a person in higher body weight? And will I make that clear to them so that they don't have to worry the entire session that the chair is going to break underneath them?
Right.
Chairs break a lot.
Yeah.
you know, I think if spaces are created for the largest bodies, they're certainly going to work for the smallest bodies. I think it matters what magazines we have in our waiting room. I think it matters what images are on our walls. I think it's really important to look around and notice that there's no pictures of fat body affirming,
right,
of beautiful fat bodies in clinicians' offices. You know, I think there's subtle ways, these are microaggressions, there's subtle ways that we're reinforcing what an attractive body looks like, or what an attractive body fits in, or who's welcome in our offices, in ways that we don't necessarily intend or take into consideration.
Mm-hmm. It's so simple, but it's like, just even by the accessibility of our furniture, we're communicating who isn't welcome in our space. Mm-hmm. Right. And I want everyone to feel welcome in my space. And it's my responsibility to make sure that my space is doing that. I think another way we can do that is on our websites, right? Like, make our commitments visible about our social justice stance, you know, and about who we serve and who's welcome.
It's incredible to me how many people don't put these kinds of things on their website. I mean, I was even looking for a new place to practice yoga in Portland recently. And I was looking through all the websites, just looking for one affirming statement, one welcoming statement. And it wasn't there. And it wasn't that they aren't, but they'd never thought to put it out there. And I just think it's really, really important, because all my clients, all the larger body people I know will not go to a place without that. And if they do need to go to a place that doesn't have that, they're going to have to send an email requesting information about the accessibility before they go. That can be avoided.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And I just want to say, yeah, chairs do break. And I broke one at a restaurant recently. And I want to put that out there. So, they do break.
They really do.
Yeah. Okay. So, number 7, be mindful of your language. Tell me more.
Yeah, we talked about that actually just a minute ago around language we use to describe bodies. I think the other thing that I want to say is that there's a distinction we can make between meeting clients where they are and using language that upholds the dominant culture, right? So so I want to kind of look at the ways that both of us have kind of worked in the eating disorder space too, but the ways that we might unknowingly say to somebody, or frankly directly say to somebody, don't worry, you know, if you do this work at healing your relationship with food, or if you recover from your eating disorder, you're not going to get fat. We're not going to
make you fat. That one.
That gets that one. It gets said over and over again.
Over and over.
And those are the ways that language can be used to uphold a really harmful paradigm.
You know, there are fat people. There always have been fat people. There always will be fat people.
Period.
And some people recovering from eating disorders, restrictive eating disorders, and smaller bodies will become fat. And that's a very major reality. And that does not have to be a terrible thing unless we're upholding these ideals of bodies that are stigmatizing.
Right.
Right. It's also looking at the ways that many therapists assume that fatness is an eating disorder.
Right.
Right. That a fat body is a problem that should be solved. We heard Roxane Gay speak at an eating disorder conference not that long ago, and somebody asked her, what do you want therapists to know? And her answer was, you know, my body has always been treated as a problem, and therapists have always tried to help me find a solution. And that shit needs to stop. Those are my words. I don't think those were hers. Yeah. Right. But that's not okay. That's just not okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that we could be doing that we're not doing is offering our clients information about alternative paradigms like health at every size and other weight inclusive approaches in just a basic informed consent kind of way. Because many clients are going to come to see you with a lot of internalized weight stigma. And so they aren't necessarily going to know that they can ask for an alternative paradigm or that one is even available. And our role as clinicians is to really, really talk about, the availability of those approaches and what they're about and what they mean. what I hear from a lot of clinicians is, I want to do this health at every size thing, but my clients aren't into it.
Right.
Of course they're not into it. You know, they're desperately trying to survive in a world that hates them, you know, particularly if they live in larger bodies, and they're definitely running from weight stigma, regardless of their size. And so, you know, we need to, if we're committed to making the world better for people of all sizes, then we need to find a way to introduce these approaches and not just put the burden on our clients to ask for them.
Right.
That's great. Okay. Number eight, and you've done this throughout this whole conversation really, but it is inviting social justice into psychotherapy. And I'm wondering if you have any more to say about that. I mean, you've been talking about it the whole time really, but.
Right. Yeah. I want to use an example that happened yesterday in my office. There was a client that I'm working with that was talking about some previous work she had been doing with a therapist somewhere else. And the therapist said to her, subconsciously, I think women want to be fat because they're afraid of coming into their full power as women.
Nuh-uh.
And I was so, and am so angry about that.
Yeah.
That, you know, that speaks to so many things. So many things, right? Like locating the problem inside of her body and saying that yes, there is power given to certain bodies over others. Yeah. And what we should all be doing is changing that system rather than changing our bodies or being afraid of. I mean, I'm still frankly a little stunned by that one.
And the idea that if women or people participated in diet culture better, they'd gain more power. It's really, really backwards. You know, I think participation in diet culture does somehow keep us from our power at times. But to think that if we did it right, we'd get more power is like really, really waiting for the patriarchy to give us the minuscule crumbs it offers.
That's right,
give me
right.
a break. That's ridiculous.
Well, thank you for that example.
Okay. I think the other thing about inviting social justice in is to remember that that oppressions are intertwined, right? So when we're talking about anti-fat bias, we can't do that with talking about all the others, right? Because oppressions, they intertwine in our culture and in our history and our society and ultimately on our bodies themselves, right? And all of them impact our ability to fully inhabit our bodies. And so we've got to be doing the work to unravel all of them and dismantle all of them.
Right. Okay. Number nine, keep questioning. Say more.
I mean, I think that this is a hard conversation to enter into if you're new. I think it brings up a lot in
For
us.
Sure,
I think,
yeah.
As I said earlier, it's really confrontational around our own relationship to our bodies and thinness and fatness and health, this idea, this big monolith we call health. And I think beginning to question, you know, when you're sitting across from someone, you know, just start, you know, beginning to notice the assumptions that are there over and over again, beginning to notice the knee-jerk reaction that I think, and, you know, in MI, we call the writing reflex, right? This idea that like, I'm going to solve the problem with you. I'm going to offer solutions. Mm-hmm. I think particularly questions around weight bring up this reflex in us. And I just think we can make a commitment as clinicians to doing more reflecting and questioning than we can problem solving around this issue in particular. I also think that sometimes when we start this conversation, it offers the opportunity to open our eyes to weight stigma. And so if you're looking for a place to start interrogating this a little in your own life, I would just start to look for weight stigma. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so folded into the fabric of everything in our world. And I think if we start to notice it more and start to interrogate whether fat jokes are funny, you know, start to interrogate, look into, you know, how safe people would be in our office, how they know they'd be welcome if they live in a larger body, that all of those are places that we can begin to change our field's response to fatness significantly.
Right. Noticing when you're entering spaces, who is the space set up for? And who is it not, right? If you're in a doctor's office and you look around and all the chairs have arms, right? Just noticing what sizes do clothes go up to in a shopping you know, in a store. There are so many ways actually that, and then this goes into ableism too, right? Like the ways that certain bodies are welcome in spaces and certain bodies aren't. Another thing I remember La Mirada Owen said is the more comfortable you are in a space, the more violent that space is for somebody else.
Yeah. I think that this issue in particular, I think, is one where folks who are committed to social justice aren't necessarily on board with this.
That's correct.
And I think we need to be asking ourselves why.
Can you say more about that, Hillary?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of my greatest missions in life is to get people to include issues around size and weight in social justice conversations. Because the impacts we see on people's lives based on weight stigma are incredibly detrimental to their lives. It infects employment, it affects access, it affects health. You know, there's constant microaggressions in the culture. The internalization is enormous. There is, you know, unless people are a part of the fat acceptance movement, they are most likely spending most of their life hustling to become part of the dominant culture. I mean, there's a tremendous amount that should be calling us forward. I think also what Carmen was saying earlier about how lots of our ideas about health are about drawing people into the standards and practices of the dominant culture is not often interrogated, mm-hmm. and that people have a wide variety of presentations in their bodies with size and shape and color, and that should all be considered just a part of body diversity, the diversity of the human condition.
I think the current dominant culture so much believes around body size that if people just tried hard enough, they could change it if they wanted to. Right. And so then the failure is seen as a lack of discipline or willpower, or that somehow there's one correct body we should all have. And I think that's one of the reasons, not the only one, certainly, but one of the reasons why this doesn't get named so much. I just ordered a couple books on social justice and counseling, and there were chapters on ableism and race and ethnicity and gender expression, sexual orientation, and size is never included in any of them. It's just not recognized as a form of oppression and as a social justice issue.
And I think often it's because in order to fold it in, we have to look at our own stuff around our bodies.
Yeah.
And we are afforded very few pathways for healing that makes sense within the context of counseling.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll be thinking about that for a little while now. I also want to say something about the questioning. You had me thinking of using your example. One of the questions I was thinking about is, do our therapeutic models require us to be interpretive or prescriptive, right? Or more collaborative and inquiry based, right?
And yes. Yes.
Yeah. Which would, I think, if you are in a more looking through a lens that requires you to be interpretive and prescriptive, it could be pretty problematic in this arena, right?
And I think it's also important to look like, am I willing to be kind of questioning and not prescriptive around everything but body size?
Yeah, great. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's very common.
Yeah. Final point, number 10, celebrate resistance.
Heck yeah. This came out of the podcast you did with Vicki Reynolds, actually, and a conversation that I had with her, right, where she was talking about when she works with survivors of torture. She said at this time that, you know, she wasn't so interested in hearing people tell the stories of their trauma. She was much more interested in hearing people tell their stories of resistance. Mm. And when I looked up the definition of resistance, because I love to do stuff like that, and it was the refusal to accept or comply with something. I want to affirm that all day long.
Yeah. Right?
I want to affirm and be an ally to people's ability to say, I'm not interested in conforming for the sake of getting that kind of power. I'm much more interested in finding a more authentic expression of power. I think people naturally resist when they're up against oppression, and I want to support that, not try to overcome it. You know, coming up from that traditional maybe psychodynamic idea that we should overcome people's resistance, I'm not interested in that at all. I want to celebrate and be an ally and uplift and encourage all day long.
And I think resistance is a particularly important topic in relationship to this healing process, you know, when people are healing from diet culture, because resistance in diet culture is seen as being you know, disobedient and not having willpower and not having discipline. And right. when I'm working with people and they're talking about that phenomenon when they're trying to follow some kind of plan, I'm like, well, maybe this is where the oppression is coming in. You know, maybe this is your reaction to not trying to uphold something that isn't that good for you.
All right. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I get to listen to this a few more times, and I'm looking forward to that. So this has been very helpful to me, and I'm sure to our listeners. And I guess my final question is, if people want to reach out to you and learn more and find out more and maybe attend a training or anything, how would they do that?
You can find me at benourished.org.
And I am at carmencool.org. And Hillary and I also in the fall will be putting together another consultation group for therapists that want to do Great. More questioning and looking into this work. And so you're welcome to either email either one of us for information about that when it's going to start.
I'm sure you're going to get emails. And I'll link, listeners, I'll link both those sites in the show notes. And I just want to say thank you again, Hillary and Carmen. Thank you very much for taking
thank
the time.
Thank you so yeah. much. You, Chris. Appreciate yeah, it.
Appreciate it. Well, that's our show, and I hope you feel about it the way that I feel about it. I hope it, it has affected or influenced you in the way that it has me, and I hope you'll share this message with other people. It is an important message. Thank you, Hillary and Carmen. So, and thank you, audience, for listening. As always, like I said, you can reach out to me via the various social media that we have. Please don't hesitate to do that. Go find us on it. Go like us. Just Google The Radical Therapist and the various social medias, and you'll be able to find us. Spread this message around, please. Let's grow the Radical Coalition. The Radical Therapist Coalition, let's grow it. So, and help us do that. Be much appreciated. And I guess that's it. Share this stuff. So, as always, my name is Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist Podcast, and thank you for listening.